7.
No migrants more in.
No Europe without Christianity.
An alliance also with Russia.
Welcome to EU Scream, the podcast that guides you through stories coming from the EU. We talk about the news a bit differently and with people who really know what they're talking about. This is episode 95. I'm your host, James Cantor, and I'm here with David Carreta. David is one of the giants among journalists in Brussels. He's been with the Italian newspaper Il Foglio, an Italian radio station Radio Radicale, known for its liberal and left libertarian values, for more than 2 decades. And he's just launched with a colleague an excellent morning newsletter, Il Mattinale Europeo. David, am I getting that right?
Il Mattinale Europeo, yes, it was right. But I'm not a giant. I'm tall. I weigh 100 kilos. I'm not a giant.
You're a giant for us. Il Mattinale Europeo.
Perfect.
Perfect. And it's on Substack. That's Morning Post Europe or European Morning Post. There's a version in French as well. And Google, of course, provides a handy translation. And let me also say, by way of introduction, David, you seem to have totally defied the post-pandemic journalistic practice of watching EU press conferences in pajamas. You reliably show up at EU press conferences, at European Union press conferences, in person, fully clothed, I should say, to hold its spokespeople, to hold its officials to account. Just like you did this past week at the European Commission's midday briefing. Here's that clip.
I was mentioning before, David, another question on this topic.
How can we trust your communication, your what you are saying on the record or off the record in this podium, if one day you say something and 1 month later you have a line to take which is completely different, you are reflecting on what to do on the process and so on?
David, I think that every day here in the press...
And if I'm not wrong, it's you trying to get the European Commission to explain why it's slow-walking promised steps to admitting Ukraine as an EU member state despite the ongoing Russian onslaught.
Yes, because almost all the time the Commission makes big announcement and then slow down the engagement. And it's especially important for Ukraine right now because the situation there is very bad.
Indeed, indeed. So thanks on all our behalves for the work and the dedication. We rely on you to ask these questions at the midday briefing. A lot of people are watching it, so they may not thank you personally, but I will. Later on, we're going to talk a bit more about the EU and Italy and about Italy's troubling legacy with fascism. But first, we're going to talk about some stories in the news, and let's get down to it. Mario Draghi, this titanic figure, the former head of the European Central Bank, he's widely credited with saving the euro currency from collapse. That after he said in July 2012 that the bank was ready to do whatever it takes.
Within our mandate, the ECB is ready to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro. And believe me, it will be enough.
That utterance was the thing that really helped tamp down the European sovereign debt and bank crises. Draghi has since stepped down from the European Central Bank, of course, but he's still a kind of Mr. Europe. He's in his mid-70s, sober, trusted. He served as an Italian prime minister as recently as 2022, so he has that credential too. And you'd think that would make him a shoo-in, an automatic choice for a top European job. And it so happens that there's a vacancy upcoming for president of the European Council, the European Council being the EU body where the EU's 27 national heads of state and government meet for their summits. So, David, why is Super Mario, probably not, in your view, going to be the next president of the European Council? That's something you wrote in your newsletter this week.
Yes, because he is Super Mario, in fact. He is the perfect person for this job, to be the president of the European Council. He's a statement. He saved the euro, as you said. as president of the ECB, the European Central Bank, as Italian prime minister during the pandemic. He convinced, for example, Ursula von der Leyen to be more protectionist on vaccines, to keep the vaccines in Europe, because at that time there was a big political crisis because everybody in US and UK were vaccinated, but not in Europe, basically because the doses that were produced in the European Union, in Germany in particular, were, and in the Netherlands, were sent to the UK. So Draghi asked to Ursula von der Leyen to be more assertive. Let's do like Trump, like Johnson. And at the end she accepted. It was quite a change for a European Commission, always attentive to business interest, to keep the market, the global market open and so on. It was quite a change to be more more focused on EU citizens than on open markets.
That's super interesting. I mean, the idea that Draghi would have helped as a former central banker bring a sort of vision of how a Europe needs to sort of compromise on some of its business values in order to save lives. Yeah, very interesting. And of course, the situation with the pandemic in Italy was terrible. I mean, there's so many people were dying, especially in the north, as I recall.
Well, but at the end, it was all Europe that the situation was horrible with the pandemic. But the fact is that in politics, you need sometimes you need strong decision and to compromise. And Draghi has this quite incredible ability to create consensus even on issues that are controversial. If you remember, at the beginning of the war, he was the guy who invented the most powerful sanction against Russia, which was the freezing of the asset of the Russian Central Bank. We were quite surprised by that decision by the European Union. And it was, in fact, Draghi who knows quite well how the markets and the central banks works.
Yeah, it was a really nuclear move to interfere in another country's central banking. That seemed to be a sort of untouchable area, even of Russian policy.
At that time, I read the news, I guess, in the Financial Times, and I said to myself, wow, we never did that, at least in the last 50 years. And then Draghi was behind another important decision, historical, I would say, candidate status for Ukraine, because still in the spring of 2022, France or Germany were very reluctant to give this status to Ukraine for different reasons, but they were saying, no, it's too early to talk about that. And Emmanuel Macron, for example, launched a big political project, the European political community, to avoid the issue of giving Ukraine the status of candidate country. And then Draghi started working on this issue, talking to Macron and so on, and the result was the three together. Draghi, Macron, Scholz, with
this trio. Yeah.
The trio, they went to Kiev, and the decision was made, in fact, in the train from Poland to Kiev, and he convinced Scholz and Macron to accept this historical decision.
That's absolutely fascinating, and we often forget just how close a role Draghi has played sort of almost behind the scenes a little bit.
Absolutely.
When it comes to keeping Europe together and shepherding these different heads of state and government to make decisions that are in the collective interest. And here we are. He seems like the obvious candidate to take a top European job, as I said, something like president of the European Council. That would be certainly one. But there are issues here.
Yeah. Because the more you are political, the more you are strong, the more you are authoritative, the less you have chance to become a president of the EU, European Council or European Commission. So basically, I don't think that they will choose Mario Draghi for that reason. If you are Emmanuel Macron, you don't want to have Draghi as the president of the European Council, because all the focus will be on Draghi. If you are Olaf Scholz, you don't want to have Draghi, because he has a vision for Europe, which is quite opposite from the German one. For example, Draghi is a supporter of European debt, common European debt, to finance European priorities, the green transition, the digital transition, the defense investments, and so on. But this is a taboo for Germany. Yeah. And the way the heads of state and government act normally is not a long-term way. It's much more short-termism. They want to have not a president, but a chairman or a chairwoman. So I think that they will not ask themselves the real question. The real question is, who will represent the EU in January 2025 at the White House if Donald Trump is again in the White House? Mario Draghi or Javier Bettel or someone else?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Javier Bettel, who was the Prime Minister of Luxembourg. He doesn't have the political stature of not even close to someone like Mario Draghi. But everything you're saying...
He's very funny, yeah.
He's very funny.
But he's not Mario Draghi.
Yeah, he's not Mario Draghi. And, you know, everything you were saying about, particularly about Emmanuel Macron being a little bit worried about being overshadowed by somebody like Mario Draghi, it makes me think of Tony Blair, right? You know, what happened in 2009 when Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, was in the running to become the council president. Merkel was among those, if I remember correctly, who ultimately soured on the idea of Blair in that job. Blair was center-left, Merkel was center-right. There was, of course, Blair's problematic record on the Iraq War, a war that turned out to have been launched on spurious grounds. There were no weapons of mass destruction, as Bush and Blair insisted. There was the issue that Britain is outside the single currency, outside the Eurozone, the passport-free Schengen system. But maybe what really stopped Blair was the fact that he was a household name, right? That he was so well known. He's kind of a political rock star for all of his faults. And he's certainly one who would have overshadowed the other leaders, because he would personally command attention in Washington, in Beijing, and in Moscow. And that's a very different kind of European Council.
And we got Herman Van Rompuy, who was at that time a Belgian prime minister.
This was
unknown by even, I guess,
the Belgians.
Yeah. some part of the Belgians.
That was
2009.
That was 2009.
2009,
of course.
Sorry.
That's when we got Herman Van Rompuy in 2009. And I guess I should try and give a little bit of information about how EU top jobs work. And let's see if, David, you think I do it right. This is effectively determined by a carving up of posts every 5 years following the European elections, which are upcoming June 6th to 9th,
yep.
2024. The other top jobs besides this council one are for the European Commission President and the High Representative for Foreign Policy. But NATO and other big postings, other big international postings, they sometimes come into this calculus. And a big factor in how these carve-ups happen is also political. That's to say, the big European political parties need to get their cut. In that sense, there needs to be a job for the socialists, for the conservatives, and for the liberals. And one more thing about Draghi, right? He doesn't have a party affiliation as such. And that is maybe a factor too.
No, I don't think so.
I love it.
This is not the basic factor. I mean, the most important one. It could have an impact, but the real problem for me, Draghi is Draghi. So you don't need a party. You choose him if you have a big crisis, and it could happen if the EU will face A big crisis in, let's say, June, a big crisis would mean a victory of Russia in Ukraine or a meltdown of the economy or something like that. Sometimes European leaders, European heads of state and governments can be courageous, but the most of the time they need a crisis to be courageous. And the choice of Mario Draghi would be a very courageous one.
Right. And let's not entirely rule it out, because you never know what
you never know.
So, David, we're talking about Draghi now because of a decision taken by the current head of the European Council, a Belgian called Charles Michel. Charles Michel has been a prime minister of Belgium, but he's certainly not a household name. And just this past week, Michel dropped a bombshell. He said he was not even going to try and stay in his job. Instead, Michel said he was going to run to be a member of the European Parliament in these elections coming up, in these European elections coming up in June. Now, Michel has been absolutely creamed by the Brussels chattering classes for doing this. Michel's decision to quit now opens the possibility, and this is the reason why people are so angry, that Viktor Orban, the autocratic and pro-Kremlin prime minister of Hungary, would automatically step into that job. That's because of a quirk of EU rules, right? That quirk states that if another person can't be found in time, the leader of the country that holds the EU's six-month rotating presidency automatically gets the role if there's a vacancy. Now, normally, these six-month rotating presidencies are somewhat ornamental. They set the agenda for ministerial meetings, and that's it. So Orban taking that position would be truly anomalous. And not only that, it would be a bit of a horror show. Orban is a friend of Donald Trump's. He's an admirer of Vladimir Putin. So Orban at the helm of Europe as war rages on its eastern flanks in Ukraine. What did you make of this decision by Michel?
But Michel's decision was a selfish one. Michel first, the European Union maybe third. As you said, this is a critical moment for the European Union because of the Russian war, because of the risk to have Trump again in the US, because of China, which is quite assertive, because of the Middle East crisis with the 27 divided in two camps, one pro-Israelian, the other one pro-Palestinian, and so on. So you would need someone to be a honest broker on this situation. And he chose to quit, because now he will be more interested in the electoral campaign instead of the technical and political work of the European Council. And
what do you know of him? I mean, why would he do something like that?
Because he's
40. Why didn't he accept the challenge of really helping to lead Europe?
Because he's young, he's 48, an ambitious guy. I guess that he wanted a top job, another top job. And the way to obtain it is to run for the European Parliament, because that would mean that he could be so-called Spitzenkandidaten of
the liberal family.
Yeah. Or he could become the president of the European Parliament maybe in 2 years and a half.
Right. So it's really that. He saw that he wasn't that popular, perhaps, as president of the European Council, which he wasn't. He certainly wasn't getting the respect that previous presidents of the European Council are getting. And so he's like, okay, how can I maneuver so that I might become president of the Commission by becoming a Spitzenkandidat of the liberal family, or perhaps become president of the European Parliament?
Or the high representative, who is the foreign affairs minister of the European Union, to simplify. The problem, I don't think that he has the political weight to be in the next top jobs race.
I mean, he had a chance to prove that he has political weight, but he seems to have blown it on a few different occasions, including occupying a chair which he should have offered to Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. So we had these accusations of sexism and misogyny.
But for once, he's leaving a chair.
That's very good. For once, he's leaving a chair, but not a whole sofa, but okay.
No, but the point is that how many people in the streets of Rome, Berlin, or even Brussels know Charles Michel?
Nobody.
That's the point. Who cares?
Yeah. He's no Draghi. He's no...
Macron. So,
yeah.
And that's why I think that his successor will be more or less the same. A nice guy, a chair, not a president, quite modest. That's all.
Yeah. All right. So who, in your view, David, are the other plausible candidates for this top job at the European Council now that Michel is leaving and now that we have fully understood why there will be hesitancy to name Mr. Europe, Mario Draghi, to that post? I mean, I've heard names batted around, including Kyriakos Mitsotakis, a conservative who's currently prime minister of Greece, the Croatian prime minister Andrej Plenković, another conservative, socialist side. There's Pedro Sanchez, prime minister of Spain. Mette Frederiksen, prime minister of Denmark. She's a socialist too. And I think you've mentioned in your newsletter, Portuguese socialist Antonio Costa, currently a caretaker prime minister, and the liberal conservative Irish prime minister, Leo Varadkar. So, I mean, are all of those names in the running? It seems like a lot.
I think that they are, almost all of them are running because for different reasons, they have internal problem, political problem with their majorities, or they are leaving, as for example, the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, who is a candidate for NATO, but I think that he could accept even to go to the Europa building to be president of the European Council and so on. So
Rutte, another liberal conservative.
He's a liberal conservative, yes.
Yeah. I mean, but officially in a liberal family, yeah, but kind of
quite,
leans...
Quite conservative, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And especially then fiscally.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have Xavier Bettel, you have Kaja
Kallas. Of Luxembourg.
Kallas, yeah. Kaja Kallas, who is the Estonian prime minister, international star after the beginning of the war of aggression by Russia.
What makes Kaja Kallas such an important figure in the Ukrainian conflict?
I think she has demonstrated leadership in terms of what Estonia has done, giving basically all the weapons to Ukraine. And then in terms of what she proposed for the European Union, she is, for example, the leader who asked for the plan to provide 1 million ammunition to Ukraine. And now she is the leader pushing to use Russian asset in favor of Ukraine.
So that would be the seizure of Russian assets and then to use that for the rebuilding of Ukraine.
Or also arming Ukraine, because we have a big problem right now, which is how to finance the Ukrainian state and the war effort of Ukraine. So basically she's... She's very nice and
she is
quite inspiring, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I knew her when she was an MEP. She's a very interesting candidate. Any others?
Oh, the list is long. You have Sanna Marin, the former Finland prime minister, young and brilliant. Then you have...
And she's what party? She leans...
Socialist.
Socialist.
Social Democrats, I guess. Then Christian Kariņš, who was prime minister of Latvia and now is foreign affairs minister of Latvia, another candidate to NATO, but you never know in Brussels what could happen. And you mentioned Mitsotakis, the Greek prime minister, Plenković, the Croatian prime minister. Klaus Johannes has said that, which is the Romanian president, because in the European Council you have presidents sometimes or prime minister.
Yeah. That's why we always do that long heads of state and government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But apart from Kaja Kallas, it's difficult to find someone inspiring.
So one more theme before we talk a bit more about Italy. We are 5 months before the European Parliament elections, with the hard right and, you know, neo-fascists too, expected to make big gains in those elections at a time of widespread public discontent over surging living costs and migration. Now, if you go to the website of europeelects.eu and you go to their latest projections of the composition of the next European Parliament, there's this very cool function where you can toggle between the result in 2019 and the projected result after June this year. You toggle to June and the screen changes color pretty dramatically. Light blue dots representing the conservatives and the dark blues of the hard right and the black dots of the neo-fascists in the identity group. And they multiply. Meanwhile, the yellow dots representing the liberals, the red dots representing the socialists, and the green dots for the greens, they all get a little bit diminished. And really interestingly, the midline between the conservatives and the liberals that was just about smack bang in the middle in 2019, that midline gets shunted to the left as the right makes gains. Drill a bit deeper and you see how the far right ID group, this identity group, this is Le Pen in France, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, the German AfD and the Austrian FPÖ, could replace the European liberals as the third biggest political family in Europe. So a key political question here, David, is whether, quotes, the center holds in the European Parliament. And by that, the center holds, I mean to ask whether the numbers of seats won by the three traditionally centrist pro-European parties, the socialists, the conservatives, and the liberals, muster enough of a majority to do the decision-making, including about who gets the jobs we've been talking about and what policies ultimately get enacted. So, first question, is the center going to hold?
I don't know. I must say that 5 years ago, around this period before the European elections, polls were predicting a big brown tsunami.
Brown being another way of saying black, like basically neo-fascist.
Yeah.
And hard right, very hard right.
Yeah.
Ultra-conservative.
But that tsunami didn't happen at the end. Quite the opposite. Pro-European parties such as the Greens and the Liberals gained at that time votes and seats at the European Parliament. This time, I think it's quite different because the far right is growing everywhere, quite a lot in France, 30% instead of 25, which means plus 4 seats in Germany.
4 more seats, yeah. For the Rassemblement of Marine Le Pen.
For Marine Le Pen, yes, yeah. Basically. And then you have Germany, where I have the alternative for Deutschland, it's in the second place. In the Netherlands, the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders has won the national election. And
he's expected to form a government, I mean,
yeah.
If he can do it.
Yeah. Then you have Vox in Spain and Chega in Portugal. 5 years ago, they were quite small. Now they are bigger. So, this time the tsunami can arrive, really, for real. But the other fact is that the European Union can be managed only by the center because of the way it functions. It's a permanent compromise. You have on one side, the European Parliament with the over 700 MIPs directly elected by the people, but on the other side you have 27 governments in the council, and you have basically one-third of conservative, one-third of progressive, one-third of whatever. And if you want to adopt a law, you need to find a compromise, and the compromise can be done at the center, not at the margin.
So where will that leave us if we do have the tsunami of neo-fascists and hard right?
Basically, if the tsunami hit, I think that there will be a reconfiguration in terms of what is the center. The center will be broadened, in a way, to some right-wing party as for example, Fratelli d'Italia in Italy, because the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, is trying to project pragmatic approach in Europe, maybe her MIPs could participate formally or informally in a new majority.
Very interesting. So you think that there might be an informal solution at that point, and that the political families that sit in the European Parliament might not necessarily change, but there would be some sort of informal solution to get laws passed.
Yeah. And in fact, this is what is happening right now, too. If you look at the votes, almost all the laws are adopted by, I would say, 70-80% of the European Parliament, which means that there is no real opposition. Why? Because those laws are always the result of a big compromise between political groups, but not only political groups, the Parliament and the Council. And also in the Council, you have to compromise between different government, and you have sometimes, as in Hungary, Poland, Italy, Poland not anymore, but for quite a long time, you have right-wing governments in the Council. So you have to find a compromise, always a compromise here.
Now, over to Italy. There was something shocking there a few days ago, shocking at least for those of us who didn't really know about it until recently. And I'm talking about the annual Acca Larentia event. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Acca Larentia.
Thank you. Okay. The video you shared on social media shows rows upon rows of neo-fascists gathered, military drill style, platoon style, at the former headquarters of the MSI. This is the Italian Social Movement, which was the heir to the fascist party founded by Benito Mussolini. First, David, what is this event?
Well, the Acca Larentia killings were a double assassination homicide that occurred in Rome in 1978. The attack was claimed by a militant far-left group. Two militants of the far right of the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian social movement, died. They were very young. So since then, since 1978, there is an annual commemoration on the 7th of January. Thousands of fascists that goes there in front of this building where the two kids were killed to make a parade. Parade shooting camerati, which is comrade in English, but in fact in Italy used just for the fascists.
So this is the thing that they're shouting on the video.
Yeah.
Camerati.
Camerati.
Yeah.
Presenti, which was a fascist cry. Mm. Camerati presenti. They do the fascist salute. And then they say, normally they say, for all fallen comrades, but comrades again, it's camerati, in the fascist way, not compagni, which is the left way of, say, comrades in Italy.
Just to be clear, so this far left group, they were charged, but they were acquitted of the murders.
The assassination was claimed by a
far left. Yeah. They actually admitted responsibility.
Yeah, the organization admitted the responsibility, but they didn't find the person responsible.
How bizarre.
Yeah. Very Italian. No, but it was in the 70s. I mean, there were quite a lot of militant groups at that time, and they were in the underground. They were not official.
What you tweeted also was the following, which I found very interesting when you shared this video. Italy, where fascism officially does not exist. What did you sort of mean by that?
The narrative of the supporter of this government, the Meloni government, the narrative is...
Of Giorgia Meloni, presently the prime minister.
Yes.
From the Fratelli d'Italia, this party that traces its roots to the MSI that we've just been talking about, that kind of picked up the heritage of Benito Mussolini after the Second World War.
So the narrative of the supporter of Giorgia Meloni basically says that fascism does not exist anymore in Italy. It's something of the past. It's in the history books. Officially, for them, there is no fascism in Italy. In fact, it's not true. It's not true because, what you have seen in this commemoration, it's something that it is repeating itself again and again. And fascism is quite widespread in the society of Italy. So fascists exist, but they pretend that it does not exist. That's the point.
And when it comes to this event, the Acca Larenzia event, the leader of the main opposition Democratic Party, Elie Schlein, has said that neo-fascist organizations should be dissolved. So what's your bet on this? Do you think that Giorgia Meloni's government is willing to do anything along those lines? And even if a government was willing to do something along those lines when it comes to these fascist commemorations, is it able to do that under the law?
Well, a government would be able to do that, but no government has ever tried, not even the center-left or left governments in Italy. This commemoration in 2018 was attended by 3,000 people, and in 2018 the Prime Minister of Italy at that time was Paolo Gentiloni, by the way, today's European Commissioner, and he is one of the leaders of the Partito Democratico, the Democratic Party, so the center-left of Italy.
And he didn't take any action?
No, absolutely not. I think that Italy has a problem with its history. Italy has an unresolved problem with fascism. All the country tend to deny it, even in the left. Italy never did the work of introspection and repentance that Germany did after the Second World War and the Nazi regime. Still today in Italy you can hear people saying, well, when he was in charge, the trains were in time. He is Mussolini. Still today you can define yourself as fascist without any consequence.
In terms of Italian law, there's sort of a cognitive dissonance here, because where is the line that the law currently draws in Italy?
There is a provision in the Constitution that prohibits the creation of fascist parties or movements, but we have plenty of fascist movements in Italy. And the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian social movement, was a neo-fascist party that was accepted because at that time they accepted the democratic logic or principles. Then we have a law from 1953 which says that it is a crime to glorify the leader of fascism or the principles or the methods of fascism, but the most of the time it is not applied because of freedom of speech. But the point for me is that from a cultural and a political point of view in Italy, it's acceptable to joke, to praise Mussolini, to call oneself a fascist, basically to be a fascist without any consequence. The underlying problem is that Italy has not come to terms with its history, and the result is a neo-fascist leader, head of government.
I mean, you're referring to Giorgia Meloni there, and one can make the contrast with what was revealed in Germany this week, where there was evidence that the Alternative for Germany discussed a kind of expulsion scheme for migrants. And immediately, Olaf Scholz, who's Chancellor of Germany, he goes to the media and says, we will not allow anyone to differentiate the we in our country based on whether somebody has an immigration history or not. I mean, at any sign of kind of fascism, you know, a German chancellor is going to react. But we just don't see that in Italy, the other main Axis country from the Second World War period.
Not at all, quite the opposite. We have the president of the Senate, which is the high chamber of the parliament, Ignazio La Russa, who has a big collection of fascist objects, even a statue of Mussolini, and he proudly displays them in the Italian television. I mean, what is that? His justification: I like history, and I'm a collector of historical objects. But all the objects are fascist.
The way that he describes it is like, oh, I'm just an admirer of history. But it keeps fascism and fascist iconography in the DNA, in the collective bloodstream of the country.
Absolutely. And nobody condemned it.
And here's the thing. Giorgia Meloni was filmed praising Mussolini in her younger days as an activist with the MSI's Youth Wing, this Italian social movement, which is itself considered the heir to the fascist party founded by Benito Mussolini. We were talking about the MSI in the context of that fascist rally a few days ago. So with that heritage, it's highly unsurprising that Giorgia Meloni should be leading the most right-wing Italian government since the Second World War. But Giorgia Meloni, these days, is accepted in international circles. She's even becoming something of a power broker. She seems to be wholly trusted by her peers in the European Council and the G7, where Italy, I think, has the presidency this year, and as an Atlanticist who will reliably support Ukraine against the continuing onslaught on that country by Russia. So I want to ask you, what about those below Meloni, the members of her own party, and particularly the most senior ones in the European Parliament? Do they come across as professional and polished like Meloni herself? And even more importantly, from a kind of European policy perspective, from a European security perspective, are they at least for now pro-NATO and pro-Ukraine?
First on Meloni. The French television published a couple of years ago an old video. It was recorded in 1996. She was a teenager, basically. She said Mussolini was a good politician. Everything he did it for Italy. And this is not found in the politicians we have had in the last 50 years. Has Meloni changed her thinking of Mussolini? I don't think so. If you go back and listen to the inauguration speech of Meloni in the Italian parliament in October 2022, you can hear Meloni condemning Mussolini's racial laws against the Jews, but she didn't condemn the fascism regime, or the Mussolini's dictatorship, or the crimes committed by Mussolini against the Italians. This is the line of Fratelli d'Italia. We condemn racial laws, but not the fascist regime of Mussolini. And why? Because the electoral basis, the historical electoral basis of that party is formed by fascist nostalgics, people from the far, far right, I would say. And the most loyal people of Fratelli d'Italia come from there. Carlo Fidanza, for example, who is one of the most prominent MIPs of Fratelli d'Italia right now, is a member of the European Parliament, is very smart and nice guy, by the way. But he was caught on camera making the fascist salute. And then he was caught on camera offering advice to this journalist who was presenting himself as an entrepreneur paid by the Russian, offering them advice to how to finance illegally his party, Fratelli d'Italia.
So that happened like 2 or 3 years ago, yeah. Right before Meloni's ascent to the prime ministership.
Yes, but this episode reveals also something else, which is the fact that Fratelli d'Italia was a pro-Russian party until 2020. Giorgia Meloni praised quite a lot Vladimir Putin in the past. recognized in 2014 the annexation of Crimea by a referendum, saying in a tweet that the issue was settled. I mean, she was pro-Putin. And there is a paradox here, a funny paradox, because she became, let's say, more pro-US thanks to the Law and Justice Party in Poland. In 2020, Meloni was elected president of the ECR party, the party of the European Conservative and Reformist group.
A party that was a group that was actually founded by British conservatives, but after they left, it was taken over partly by the Law and Justice Party of Poland, this ultra-conservative party.
Yeah, so she was elected president of this party, and obviously the Polish were not happy with her stance on Vladimir Putin for quite comprehensible reasons. And suddenly she stopped to talk about Russia. And it was, she was quite lucky because 2 years later, Putin started his war against Ukraine. And suddenly Meloni became a pro-Ukrainian, anti-Russian, pro-US leader at that time at the opposition. But this situation has helped her quite a lot when she became prime minister to project this image of a responsible leader.
So how soon, I mean, this is a crazy question, but how soon does Meloni begin to show her pro-Russian instincts again? Let me put it this way. If there's this latent pro-Russian, well, it's really a pro-Putin affinity because of the ultra-conservative values that Putin puts forth about everything from LGBT to the idea that there should be a strong central leadership of a country, da-da-da, and the idea that the European Union is a supranational state that robs us of our national identities, all of that stuff. How soon does that stuff well up again, either in Giorgia Meloni or in the members of her own party, and become a problem?
I think that it's a problem today for some members of her party, because this is their instinct. When it will come up with Meloni, I see two possibilities. The first one, when and if Donald Trump will be elected president.
Right.
And so the scenario of Putin winning the war, Trump at the White House, then clearly Meloni will come back to the original version of Meloni. The other possibility is a big crisis in Italy, for example, an economic crisis or something like that. For the moment, the situation is quite good. She has had some success, for example, with the recovery plan of Italy and so on. Even on migration, the European Union is helping Meloni a lot, violating the EU principles and rules sometimes, but they are helping Meloni. She is managing quite well as prime minister. But in case of a big crisis, the temptation will be to find an enemy outside. And the enemy will be the European Union.
It'll be Brussels.
Of course, Brussels.
Brussels is
the French, because they don't like the French. I don't know why, but they don't like the French. The Germans, because we have a problem always with the Germans. Basically, they will try to find someone else to give them the responsibility of Italian problems. In that moment, it's a political cocktail, and one of the ingredients of this cocktail is Russia and Vladimir Putin.
That's it for this episode. But one more thing before you go. We've just created an easier way to become a material supporter of EU Scream. It's simple. You look for EU Scream at patreon.com and you pledge what you can monthly. Now, as you probably know, EU Scream is nonprofit journalism. We might occasionally do partnerships and take advertising, and we're grateful to the Laura Kinsella Foundation for an annual grant. But here's the thing, we need your support to bring you more content more regularly, and there are a lot of you already listening. After all, there's a lot to talk about, from the EU's troubled borders to accelerating climate change, to whether we control AI or it controls us. It's your support that helps us delve into how the EU is responding to these issues, with people who really know what they're talking about.
Small donations to large ones, it's all incredibly appreciated. It also helps when we get a 5-star rating at Spotify or a review at Apple Podcasts. And passing on episodes to family members, colleagues, and friends, that's yet another great way to show support. For more details and for more EU Scream, do please visit euscream.com. And thanks for listening.